Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Five Heart Podcast, brought to you by Coronation.com, part of the SB Nation Podcast Network. I'm your host, Greg Mahochko, and joining me, too sweet to be sour, the man of the hour, Hoss Reuter, Dr. Offense with a minor in defense, and he's excited to flex his associate's degree in special teams this week. Right, Hoss?
That's good. That's good. I might have to put that on a LinkedIn profile.
There'd be a D2 school. What's that?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was going to say, you put that on LinkedIn, there'd be a D2 school be like, associate's degree in special teams. We need him. Let's get him over to University of Nebraska, Kearney.
Hey, Kearney is a fine little town. I love Kearney. Cunningham's down on the bricks. Great burgers. The Kerry Coors Banquet, good place. Still trying to figure out how UNK rejected me for graduate school, but the big school, the University of Nebraska, let me in. So
I think it all worked out. That one out. All worked out for the better.
Yeah. Oh god, yeah. Too sweet to be sour. Is that Dusty Baker or Dusty Rhodes, or was that Muhammad Ali?
Not Dusty Baker.
Yeah, Dusty Baker. I was like, wait, shit. Baseball GM.
No, that would be. Yeah, that would be the American dream, Dusty Rhodes, baby.
I have wined and dined. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had a DVD back in the day when I was a wrestling fan in my teens. Yeah, the documentary about him. Interesting guy.
Yeah. Well,
all right, let's dive in.
Because I have been monitoring the comments and people don't like the chit-chat. So we're gonna just pitter-patter and get at her here. We were talking about this, and it's not like the top story or anything like this, but this is what we were talking about as you jumped on the Zoom and you were very confused as to why I was just staring blankly at the screen. It's because I was watching the video from a couple days back of the Nebraska's alternate uniform hype video, I guess if you want to call it that, that dropped in homage to the 83 scoring explosion team, the Mike Rozier, Turner Gill, Dean Steinkuhler, etc. So I was watching. I'm like, you know what? I like it. It's classic. It's not over the top. It feels like it fits. It feels like it's going to be just another Saturday. But now that they can, you know, maybe make a little extra cheddar on selling some alternate uniforms.
I like them too, and honestly, I think those should probably be our full-time uniforms. The ends on the sleeves, get rid of the stripes on the sleeves, and it's just a really clean look. I think some of the 80s ones also had like Huskers and big print across the front too. I don't know if they wore those ones in 83 with the big print on the front, but yeah, looks good, and they should bring back some 80s logos for the apparel for the alternate uniforms, like we were talking about earlier, the tilted helmet script Huskers, best logo that we have.
That particular design would have been on like the starter jackets of the day, would it not?
Yeah. Yep. Star jackets. Like I know, like I have a relic of a old crew neck sweatshirt that was my dad's in the '90s with that logo on there. I mean, come on, like retro is cool again. Let's go with that instead of the Walmart looking new Herbie Husker, the new one, old school Herbie I absolutely love. New Herbie I absolutely hate. Don't get me started on Little Red. And the interlocking NU logo looks like a cheap ripoff of Oklahoma or the University of Utah. Like, I know that's been around technically since like the 1950s, but it's not a good look.
Hoss, I have to ask you while we're talking about logos and things like that, in all honesty, what are your thoughts on the classic?
See, I love that. I love that logo because it's in the spirit of that tilted helmet script Huskers logo. You know, it's just timeless. And I can't believe I'm going into detail in a football podcast about graphic design, but here we are.
And for those of you not watching the YouTube but just listening to the podcast, I'm wearing a black shirts t-shirt, my black shirts t-shirt, which, by the way, I'm almost due for a replacement. The screen print
you buy
on
that
this.
Thing at Stephen Barry's in Lincoln back in like 2005.
I no. Can I give? I guess I can give a free plug. Cornborn.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
So, I got this shirt from them. I think I got my my old school Herbie shirt from them as well. That might not be the case, but this for sure. And oh, I know what it was. It was this black shirt. And then when my oldest was a baby or a toddler, I got him a couple of Husker shirts as well that now my twins have outgrown. So that's how long that's how much I am due for an upgrade in Husker apparel. But as we were talking before we started rolling sound, that three stripe life, not so good on the fan apparel, Hoss.
No, they're, again, we're talking graphic design on a football podcast, but every year I do the same thing. It's to late July, early August. I'll go to Shields, Husker Hounds, wherever carries, you know, Adidas Husker apparel, and buy a new shirt, new hoodie, something for the season. As a hat guy, I'm pretty loyal to hats. I have the old school Herbie one that I bought in 18. That thing is not the same color it was when I bought it. You know, I'll put a picture on Twitter or something. It's tan when it was charcoal gray when I first bought it. I just worn it outside so much, you know, in the summer. But yeah, Adidas, man, like some of these designs, they must just, and I hate to sound like old man yells at cloud right now, but I'm going to. I mean, is their marketing design department just solely dedicated on researching what's popular for like Gen Zers or something? Because I mean, this stuff, it's like, yeah, I'm 31 years old. I don't want to wear that shit. Like, right. It's ridiculous. Give me a simple crew neck sweatshirt and on the left chest, Adidas logo on the right chest. Boom. There you go. Nothing fancy. Simple, clean.
In this conversation, you get all spurned out of the alternate jersey, which for years, I mean, they've talked about these alternate uniforms as, you know, recruiting tools. And oh, if you change up your look, then the recruits are really good. I don't know if, and maybe it's just because I'm 40. Yeah, I'm 40, and I'm not even half as young as, or half as old as John. So we don't have to worry about that. But being that I'm 40, I don't, you know, I don't think like a 16, 17, 18 year old kid, but I can't imagine that, you know, like the look on the field would impact my decision. Am I wrong on that? Is that just the old disenfranchised old man mentality? Or when you're recruiting or being recruited by Nebraska, is it, you know, how does their scheme fit what I bring to the table? How can they help get me to the next level? And are we a good fit? You know, is it a hand in the glove situation, not a jersey on the torso type of situation?
Yeah, I think it's just a case of getting older and focusing on what's truly important. You know, you're there to play football. You're there to win games and prepare yourself for the next level in life, whether it be in the NFL or just going to work in a career. Basically, just maximizing who you are. Your potential is who you are. I think a jersey would be secondary to that. I mean, the alternate uniform craze came about because Oregon was wearing, you know, 368 different combinations of uniforms back in, like, starting in 2007. They were on the cutting edge. Nobody else was doing that, really. I mean, you had Notre Dame wearing their Kelly Green stuff every once in a while, but can't really think of too many schools that had an alternate uniform altogether. And then it just kind of took off from there. And I think it kind of played itself out probably – I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. Now everybody does it. I mean, and I think it's kind of, I like how, and you can't do much with just red and white in terms of alternate uniforms. So, you know, it is what it is. But I like how we're starting to kind of look at, you know, honoring, you know, past teams. You know, we wore the 1997 throwbacks back in 2017. Now we're wearing the 1983 ones. We've worn the 1918 throwback uniforms back in 2018, which were actually really sharp in person. I was at that Illinois game. But, you know, we have the black shirts one, but I don't think it needs to be anything crazy. Unless, of course, you know, I've always said a flat matte white helmet, you know, would be a nice contrast with the gloss red. But I mean, you're always going to see subtle changes with Nebraska's uniforms, barring going, you know, the black shirt scheme.
I think the last year that they offer, or not offer, but the last year that they have an alternate jersey, they should just go whole hog. All right, we're the Cornhuskers. You know what that helmet's going to look like? It's going to be yellow kernels of corn right there with the N. No. Just once. You know what? Even at the time, I'd be like, this is a horrible idea, but I think that would officially bury the notion of alternate uniforms forever.
Forever. You got to wear them against like Illinois.
Yeah. I didn't even see when they were planning on busting those bad boys out.
I believe, I don't know if it's for certain, but I believe it's the Oklahoma game.
Okay. Well, that'd be, you know, fitting, I think.
I mean, we also could wear them against Minnesota because we scored 84 points against Minnesota in 1983. That'd be a nice, you know, F you to old PJ Fleck. Even though he's a hell of a coach, I can't diss on him.
Yeah. You know what? Now that you're back, I need you to be more bitter and angry about other teams in the conference.
I can't be bitter and angry until we do anything, just something. Beat Northwestern convincingly. Start 3-0. Beat Oklahoma. Okay, I might start drinking the Kool-Aid. But I'm fully to the point now where I'm like, don't tell me about the labor. Show me the baby. It's been the same thing for the past 4 years. I'm tired of it. This is a results-oriented business. Do it. Do or do not. You know, it's like John Taffer in Bar Rescue said, I don't embrace excuses. I embrace solutions. I'm tired of the excuses. Frost saying our game plan went out the window when Illinois lined up in an odd front. Then you got Matt Lubick saying, no, we had plays in the playbook.
Right.
I'm tired of those excuses because anybody with half a, you know, brain cell of football intelligence knows that you have blocking rules built into your blocking schemes on, okay, if they're in an odd front, if the player's lined on, you know, if there's a B gap bubble on both sides, and the tackles in the center are covered up. Okay. We go with our covered uncovered rules. You just don't scrap the whole damn thing out the window. I mean, like, so I got to see some progress before I start becoming the bitter old war horse that I was in 2017, 2018. I'm just too much of a fan of football in general, you know, like obviously I love Husker football,
sure.
But when it comes to just football in general, you know, I just, if somebody's good, as much as I don't like them personally because they beat my team, like I got to tip the hat.
I thoroughly enjoyed yours and John's conversation last week about the defense. And I think it gave certainly myself and probably a lot of others a better appreciation for defensive linemen. And I know we had talked in the past about Bill Parcells' big man theory, but in the course of that conversation, it was kind of, and I think John was guilty of being under the assumption that, you know, like the big guys up front are just the meatheads without a whole lot between the ears. And you debunked that theory. So I do have a question for you, and maybe you answered it. And I don't want you to slant negative, but maybe you answered it in the course of last week's conversation. Okay. If defensive linemen are smarter than we would have anticipated in the modern college football game, who would possibly be regarded as, or what position group would be regarded as the one where you needed the least amount of intelligence or football savvy, maybe?
Honestly, I'd probably have to say running back. Because, you know, at that position, God-given athleticism can cover up a lot of shortcomings. I mean, you see it if you have a subpar offensive line but a really good back, i.e. Amir Abdullah, Rex Burkhead, those kinds of guys, they can still go for anywhere from 1,300 to 1,700 yards, even running behind a subpar offensive line just because of their natural talent. And then, I mean, they're being told the naming process for plays has changed considerably in the past 15 years, but like back, under the Tom Osborne era, it could be like pro right 41 pitch. Okay. Running backs, the four, the hole that it's aimed that the play is going towards is the one on the far right. 41 tells the back where to go. There's memorizing steps, but they're not memorizing names, you know, things like that, you know, names of the plays. They have to read some defensive alignment, but they're not making pre-snap checks and reads as often. That's changed a little bit in more of a shotgun spread game with, you know, being able to see the front seven and picking out who your responsibility is in pass protection based on, is it a half slide, full slide, big on big protection, all those things. So I think that when you really think about what position can get away with not being as football savvy, it's definitely running back.
When I was thinking about this earlier this week to myself, I thought maybe running back for a lot of the reasons, but then I also thought that sometimes, you know, running back's got to step in there and you know, plug a gap from a blocking standpoint, you know, for any pass protection. So I thought based on the way the conversation, and I, like, folks, I'm not asking this question to shit on any particular you know, unit on the team, but based on the nature of the conversation last week, I would have thought maybe defensive back.
No, coverage. You want to talk advanced calculus?
Okay,
coverage.
All right.
Oh my gosh! Like
maybe
for DB, you're switching on the fly, so your procedural knowledge of what you're doing on the play, you might think, okay, they're in 2x2. I'm to the boundary. I'm aligned, you know, outside the you know, between the hash and sideline on the boundary. That's my guy. You know, after 5 yards, if he's still running straight at me at 5 yards, that's my guy. It's man-on-demand coverage. And then maybe there's a switch. Maybe there's an in-cut or an out-cut. Maybe he steps back at the screen. Everything's changing on the fly as they're going 100 miles an hour after the ball is snapped. So I think that's why, like, that's a good example of how Nick Saban is such a tyrant when it comes to teaching defensive back play. Because – I mean, there's so much that they have to account for, and the game's only getting more wide open as time goes on. So you're seeing a lot of different route combinations, and you're seeing some elite athletes that you're going up against. At the other end of the spectrum, I mean, it's no secret, quarterback play. Quarterback is the position that requires the most football savvy and intelligence. I mean, Bruce Arians, in his book, The Quarterback Whisperer, talks about how a good, successful quarterback has to have the study habits of like a Harvard doctorate student.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have to be absolutely consumed by it. They have to know the information inside and out. And it's a sheer volume of information they have to know. They have to know their stuff, what the offense is doing, you know, run plays, pass plays, steps, reads, progressions, all that. But then they also have to know what the defense is doing, alignments, coverages, blitz tendencies, personnel mismatches. And then, you know, they might have to get to a point where they're starting to anticipate, okay, it's 3rd and 3. We're on the boundary. We're inside our own 20. This team likes to run a boundary cornerback blitz, so I got to be on the lookout for that and, you know, alert the receiver to that side or check into something else altogether at the line of scrimmage. So, I mean, quarterbacks, you talk about, you know, there's studies where they do brain scans, like London cab drivers, to see how they know 3,000 possible routes around central downtown London. Sure. Well, those brain scans show that they have a larger hippocampus in their brain. The anatomical structure is actually larger in their brain compared to the brains of just normal, everyday working class Joes like you and I. I bet if somebody did that for quarterbacks would have the same increase in hippocampal volume.
Again, folks, I'm not here to degrade, downplay the importance of the defensive backs. It just occurred to me when so much focus last week was being given to defensive linemen, and maybe it's just that it was the first time that linemen got their true due respect intelligibility speaking, but it sounded that through the course of last week's conversation between you and John that it was like, oh, you know, similar to a running back, you know, if they're physically talented enough, they can overcome a lot of things. But through the course of your response here, Haas, I you're right, because everything that a defensive back does is so reactionary that they have to be able to, you know, do so many calculations at once to make sure they're in the right spot, defending the right guy, etc. So again, that was no disrespect to defensive backs. I mean, short of like the placeholder, you know, I didn't know if you know, placeholder.
Hey, that job as a placeholder, you know, is 99% boredom, 1% sheer terror. But no, thank you for bringing this conversation about the defense up. Because I had something written down. I was reading the press conference that Eric Chenander had earlier this week after their big weekend scrimmage. And he said that one of the things that he was most impressed with was how well the defense communicated, and there was no difference in their execution in terms of alignment between their base defense, nickel defense, and dime defense. And that's a point where I don't want to get too deep in the weeds. I've already gotten deep in the weeds with educational psychology, talking about functional brain scans of hippocampal volume. But procedural knowledge, the knowledge of how to do something. You have declarative knowledge, you have procedural knowledge. Declarative knowledge is what something is. So Greg's hat is red. Procedural knowledge is how to do something. Okay, Minnesota's in a 3-by-1 with the Y, the tight end, attached off the line of scrimmage. What are we going to align into? And I'm specifically referencing Minnesota because we had some serious alignment issues against them last year. And some of them were by design. We got into a tilt front a few times to try to take away the cutback lane on duo and on inside zone. And other times we just struggled to align properly because the player – themselves were not aligned. So we are having issues with our safeties, you know, being too far width-wise outside the box. We had them a little bit too tilted where one was fitting down inside the box, one was playing the one high, but he was all the way removed across the field from the trips. So that procedural knowledge of knowing how to align, I think, is really important for this year's defense to just go out there and execute. Alignment is nine, like possessions, 9/10 of the law. Alignment is 9/10 of football. Yeah, alignment, assignment, execution. If your alignment is correct, you're closer to executing your assignment properly. Once you're aligned and you know your assignment, that's where just natural football ability and development can take over. So the fact that this defense is not showing any drop off between base, nickel, and dime, that's huge, because nickel and dime, I've been saying this for years on this podcast, that's situational football. Our Achilles heel for the past however many years has been playing good situational football. If it's 3rd and 8 and they're in a bunch formation and we're in nickel, we better know exactly what our bunch checks are. Are we blitzing the formation? Are we calling off a blitz? Are we getting into a different coverage? Where's the ball on the field? You know, on the hash, or, you know, towards the boundary, or is it towards the field? You know, all those things. So I'm very encouraged by that. And that's the mark of a good coach. You know, in football, there are no secrets in football. You exchange film with the other team. Everybody's running the same basically the same schemes, whether it's blocking schemes or coverage schemes, blitzes, all that stuff. It's all about two things: when you call it in a game and how well do you teach it? So for the procedural knowledge of being able to get in and out of all these sub packages without any drop off, that right there tells me that Eric Chenander is doing a really good job of teaching this defense so that these guys know what to do to go out there and execute. Sorry, I ran there.
No, it's great. And I have a follow up question, but I wanted you to go back to those words you used at the very beginning. Procedural
knowledge and declarative knowledge.
So if I'm oversimplifying it, and if I'm wrong, please tell me, it's knowing what something is versus knowing how or why something is, right? So in the old adage that I like is like knowledge versus wisdom. Knowledge is knowing that a tomato is a fruit. Wisdom is not putting it in a fruit salad, you know?
Yeah, that's perfect. That's a good encapsulation. You've developed procedural knowledge over a lot of years based off of what? The declarative knowledge. That's good. I'm gonna write that one down.
Thank you. Thank you. It's nice that I can educate you for a change. No, I want
to
go back.
I'm open to all sorts of information.
When we go back, and this is what I'm about to bring up is a subject. It is from the past, but I'm not, you know, trying to, relive the glory days, but it was often said in the 90s, by players or coaches, probably mostly by players with a little bit of that bravado that, hey, you know what, that Husker offense, the toughest defense that they faced all season long was the Husker defense in practice. The toughest offense that the defense faced was the Nebraska offense in practice. And when times are good, that's great. You know, when you know you're coming off of, you know, national championships or, you know, 20 plus years of 8-9 wins, you know, with the schedules being what they are at the time, you know, it was fewer games, but 9-10 wins and 11 wins, but sustained success. When we fast forward to recent years and you either it's, you know, a controlled scrimmage like the red white game, the spring game, or, you know, what we're basically just in now, which is, you know, preparation now for Northwestern. I think we're turning the page this coming week looking, you know, towards Northwestern. But can you, if the defense is, you know, holding firm and standing pat and having success, is it because the defense is as good as we expect them to be with all the additions, or is it because the offense hasn't found their rhythm yet? Is there, if one side of the ball is proving to be more dominant in practice, is that a concern, or is it just, is it because of they're not playing as good of competition in practice, or is it because they're an outstanding, you know, unit of football? Any thoughts on my rambling there?
I think it's probably, actually, I wouldn't call that a ramble. It was very articulate. I followed along the entire time.
Thank you.
I think it's probably a little bit of both. Defense playing really well, having experience, you know, all that experience and the coaching staff on that side of the ball, having some new additions. And then I think the other side of it, I mean, it could, for all we know, the offense could be really bad. You know, we're not down there in practice, so we haven't seen it. But I'm more willing to bet that it's an offense that's still trying to find its sea legs, so to speak. When you have new coaches, new players, new quarterbacks, new offensive coordinator, not even just new position coaches, and you're marrying kind of two visions of what you want the offense to be together, you know, Whipple's passing game and some maintaining some elements of the running game from under Frost. I think there's a lot of inexperience there from – you just don't have live game reps yet. So hopefully preparing through practice against our defense for the duration of fall camp has prepared them, you know, to get ready to play a Big Ten conference game. And what, by the time this episode airs, 8 days from now. But yeah, I think it's a little of both. A little bit of both, because defense is always going to be a little bit ahead of the curve through fall camp, just because of the nature in which defense is played. It's not just, you know, read and react, you know, going, you know, just balls to the wall without thinking about what you're doing. But once you understand, hey, no matter what they're doing, like for defensive line, no matter what they're doing, these are your keys based on what alignment we're in. You know, one of those things.
Is that a standard across the board, or is that a Nebraska specialty? Like, is it because the defensive side of things is a little bit more, as a unit, coaching staff, et cetera, it has a little bit more of cohesion from just being here at Nebraska? At, you know, I know they're newer pieces, but or is this something that's college football wide?
I think it's probably defense being ahead of the offense, probably college football wide as practice starts. But I think that in our case, our, you know, individual experience as a program, that having all that turnover on one side of the football and then having almost complete, you know, stability on the other side, aside from some, you know, some players leaving, going to the NFL draft, future transferring out, I think that's probably what magnifies the issue a little bit more. Because, like I said, you know, offensive side of the ball, they're adjusting to a new language still. So, whole new way of doing things. They're developing new procedural knowledge that they haven't had a chance to test out in a live game situation. Scrimmages are supposed to simulate test conditions. Everybody knows that it's, you know, it does, but it's just not quite the same.
It won't be real until, you know, Casey Thompson, you know, gets free and you know, or, you know, takes a shot, or you know, whomever is the running back at the you know, like just that first real pop of the football season, you know, that's when you know we're here, you know, we're not in Kansas anymore.
We're in Ireland.
That's going to be fun. I have questions. I feel like a little bit's going to be jumping the gun ahead of next week with Todd and John. But in the event that I'm not here this week, I'm going to go ahead and pick your brain now. As we look to Northwestern, as you said, 8 days away from the time this episode drops, what are your... And maybe we can look a little, you know, zoom out on the microscope. Maybe this is a little bit more macro. And we'll get into predictions next week, whether I'm here or not. But what are your honest expectations for Nebraska football 2022?
Go to a bowl game?
I don't mean...
7-5.
So that's
expectations in what way?
Right. And I was going to say, and your response was like the super paint with broad strokes, but how do you see, I'm trying
like,
to ask.
What do I expect how this team to play? Like, yeah. Is that what you're asking? Like, what do I expect game to game?
And again, without getting into the game to game predictions, which we'll do next week, but how do you, with that oddball trip to Ireland aside, and then a couple of you know, pay to play games against some FCS schools after that, and then Oklahoma comes to, like, how do you see this team growing as a team over the next 2 months?
Well, first and foremost, eliminate turnovers. Take care of the football. The other team's already trying to beat you. Don't give them any help. The second one, be the more physical team. And that can – being the more physical team doesn't mean that you're going to be more talented than they are, because, you know, like, Oklahoma's recruited better than we have. You know, we've recruited well, but Oklahoma's out just in that next tier. And along with, like, the Michigan, you know, Michigan kind of program. Wisconsin and Iowa recruited their same level. But be the more physical team. Physically beat people up in games. Be clean execution-wise. No dumb pre-snap procedural penalties. No late hits out of bounds. If you get called for holding, fine. That's an effort penalty. Anybody can live with an effort penalty because you're trying to get something done. You don't want to have to live with just stupid penalties like what we saw over the years from, you know, guys like Char. I'm totally drawing a blank on what that DB's name was. Number 21, graduated here in 19, Charles Jackson.
Sure.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, like, he gets a dumb late hit penalty against Purdue, not wipes an interception off the board. Or just some of the stupid stuff that we've seen over the years, targeting penalties. From the safeties, the two safeties that graduated last year, Deontay Williams and Markell Dismuke. You don't want to see those. We can argue what targeting is another time, because we all are wondering the same thing, because some stuff you know, doesn't look like it should be targeted.
Your mileage but may vary.
No dumb penalties. Execute. Be more physical. Win the kicking game. You know, if you get outrushed by your opponent, you still win the game. Who gives a shit? You know, if you got outrushed, you won the game. If they throw for more yards than you, but you still win the game, who gives a shit? You won the game. But the kicking game, if you're starting at your own 10 on average and your opponent's starting at your own at their own 41-yard line, you're going to be in trouble because you're not going to win the game. That's a stat that's often overlooked, and we need to rectify that because too many times in the past 4 years, we have been playing tight games in the shadow of our own goalposts.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prop G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
To that point, Hoss, you're absolutely right. I feel like, especially in recent memory, but probably within the last decade, which I know for most people's technically recent memory, but I got shit memory. Nebraska has had it. This, you, especially when you look at the games that, that were L's, you know, at the end, the inability to flip the field where you're always in your own side of your own half of the 50 and you have no room for error for a team that, you know, historically had made a lot of errors, you know, just being able to breathe a little bit, make the other, this was a great point that you made last week with John was Chenander's philosophy of making them earn it by eliminating the big plays, you know, because by, you know, law of numbers, if they're out there, you know, for 10 plays on a drive or more, there's a chance that they're going to mess up. Whereas if they hit a home run on the second play, you know, your offense gets back out on the field, but because the other team scored in a big, big, dare I say, embarrassing manner. So,
yeah. Psychologically damaging, man. I mean, you can't be going the distance, having to go the distance the entire field to score. You got to be able to win the field position game because I think your chances, I forget who did the study, but your chances of scoring go through the roof when you're starting at even your 30 yard line, your own 30 compared to your own 20. And so if you can win the hidden yardage and not play a game in the shadow of your own end zone, like the 2019 Nebraska-Iowa game where, I mean, it felt like it was a cause for celebration if we crossed midfield because everything was back on one end. That's why I'm really excited about what Bill Bush can do with the special teams unit and find a way to get extra possessions, basically. You know, steal a possession or two because, hey, they've got, you know, 3rd and 13 on their own 10-yard line. You know, they're in the shadow of their own end zone. They punt. We get the ball at our own 35, our own 40. And you're how's a good way to put this? You're shortening the game because you're able to drive the ball down and score covering less distance. You're effectively ending the game sooner. Like, I need to flesh that one out a little more because it sounds better in my head than it does when I talk about it out loud.
There is no, that's great. I'm trying to. I remember now. This is NFL, so you know I apologize. but I look at, I think it's the 2009, it would have been 2000, crap. Would have been the 2008 season culminating in the 2009 Super Bowl. Yeah, that tracks.
You're talking about New Orleans Saints, Indianapolis Colts?
Nope, not crap. What am I talking about? The Super Bowl that was played in 2009, sir?
Oh, Steelers.
But I say that because in the postseason, in the playoff game against the San Diego Chargers, they came out in that 15-minute third quarter. Pittsburgh had possession of the ball for over 12 minutes. I mean, when you talk about shortening the game, they literally took – I mean, they took the ball out of Phillip Rivers' hand. And that's what I like. I like sustained drives. And it gets to my next question for you is, when you look back at tendencies, when you look back at you know, certainly the past 4 years at Nebraska and then, excuse me, before that at UCF, is Scott Frost more of a sustained drive guy or a swing and hit the home run guy?
That all depends. That all depends on what year you're talking about, who he's got at quarterback. Because
that's fair.
In 17 at UCF, they could do both. They could score on the big play. They could also grind out sustained drives. In 18 at Nebraska, I'd say we were a little bit more. It was weird because we'd hit big plays, but we wouldn't necessarily score on them. It was more right. of a sustained drive. 19, that was just an abysmal offense to watch at Nebraska. We'd score on big plays, but we had a lot of problems sustaining drives. In 2020, I've tried to scrub that entire football season from my memory because of how weird it was with COVID.
Exactly.
And then 2021, it was the by hook or crook, find a way to score somehow. Sometimes we'd hit a big play. Sometimes we'd just cobble together a drive. We'd miss a field goal. We'd overthrow somebody. I mean, like that team last year had a lot of quirks. It's hard to define that one, you know, whether it was a big play or, you know, sustained drive team.
I almost feel like I'm not making an excuse. I'm not being superstitious, but last year's team felt very snake bit.
Yes.
And
very snake bit.
And to
the Buffalo game's a great example last year. We win that game 28-3, but we had, what, three touchdowns called off the board? Two because of penalties, one was a near touchdown. And then we missed three field goals, so that's 21. That's 30 points. I mean, you beat Buffalo 58-3. That looks a hell of a lot better than beating them 28-3.
Right. Again, I'm not here as an apologist. I'm not, you know, the man's defender or knight in shining armor, but you could say that going back to year one with missing that game against Akron and then having to open up against Colorado, that not to say, I mean, that anything would have changed if they play that lightning cancel game, but there has been, you know, you mentioned the COVID year. There has been just a lot of oddity around Scott Frost's time in Lincoln.
That is true. You know, the lightning strike and all that, but in terms of COVID, hey, 118 other teams had to deal with it too, you know, and we still crowned a national champion that year. So you got to find a way to overcome those things.
But I'm not disagreeing. When we
you talk know that about, I always try to reel it back in. I miss the days of being a homer.
Yeah.
I'm begging this football program, please give me a reason to drink the Kool-Aid again.
Right.
All I'm asking. Like, I'm willing, but I'm not going to do it under my own volition.
What would it take? I can't say week one, week zero. What would it take from Nebraska's performance against Northwestern in Ireland for you to be like, all right, hand me that jug. I'm ready for the Kool-Aid. What would the statement have to be? What would that final score have to look like for you to be like, well, that's a Big Ten team on neutral ground in a completely different country. What would that look like, or what would that have to look like for you to be like, well, Skip, pass me that red Solo cup of Kool-Aid. I'm ready.
Okay, it would have to take a win like last year against them, 56-7. You know, so a 56-7, and I won't even say that astronomical of a score. I'd say we go to Ireland and we win something like 42-24, 42-21. Yeah, I'd be like, okay. But then I'd also be thinking, boy, that team was 3-9 last year too, Northwestern. So my enthusiasm would be tempered. But if you want to ask what it would take for me to just be like, you know, belly up to the bar and get a big, nice, tall pint glass of Kool-Aid, it'd be beating Oklahoma. And not only just beating them. Obviously, I'll be drinking the Kool-Aid if we beat them by 1 point. But if we beat Oklahoma something like 31-17, you know, jumped on them early and just, you know, didn't let up, that's when I'd be, you know, basically doing a Stone Cold Steve Austin beer bash with the big red Kool-Aid. And that's not being a bandwagon fan. It's just being a little apprehensive and acknowledging, like, we have a lot of question marks. And as somebody who's not only a fan of Husker football, but also just a fan of the game of football, you know, I like to evaluate, you know, what I'm seeing and, you know, really, for lack of a better term, get really empirical about it. And that's where I have such a hard time drinking Kool-Aid, because I see one thing where I'm like, that's not a good product. And then my fandom's like, well, just, you know, drink a little bit of the Kool-Aid. And it's like, no, not to pat myself on the back too much here, but it's like, I know too much about the game at this point to drink the Kool-Aid, but I want to. I want to drink the Kool-Aid.
We're ready for you to come back.
Yeah, I am too. At this point, like, I almost feel like it's this segment's like Robin Williams talking to Matt Damon and Good Will Hunting. It's not your fault, you know. Like, that's what it feels like.
And that's where, you know, I have to throw this disclaimer out, because in no way am I comparing being a fan, you know, to any of the more traumatic experiences that people go through in life. But it's a situation where it's tough to trust, because we've been hurt before.
Once bitten and twice shy.
It's like, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
Now, I will say, you know, even though I don't drink the Kool-Aid, as the parlance is, it doesn't mean like I don't. It doesn't mean that I'm not as passionate about Husker football. I mean, for crying out loud, I'm on a podcast. You know, I'm a co-owner, co-host. I don't know what the word would be of a podcast. I'm passionate about it. So, like, last year's Michigan game, I haven't hurt like that after a loss in a long time. Like, when I was leaving that game, I was thinking, man, this feels like being at that 2006 Texas game when Terrence Nunn fumbled on 3rd and 3. Like, that Michigan game's going to stick with me for a long time. That one hurt. But I want a reason to be excited again. I want to get back to the point where, you know, when I travel and I see somebody in a Missouri Tigers t-shirt, that I feel the urge to talk shit to them. Or an Iowa Hawkeye. Lord knows, like, I see enough Iowa Hawkeye gear on a daily basis in Omaha. It's like, I want to be able to talk shit to those guys, and I can't because, well, they've had scoreboard over us for the past 7 years.
I feel like this is going to be a fun conversation for next week when we have John and Todd here. Can we, as fans, get beyond our Nebraska nice and just start with seething anger and hatred toward every other team in the conference?
I would love that.
Okay.
And I don't know if I should say next what I was going to say, but you know,
is that something?
Nebraska game I was at that we lost. I'm not going to name the team. Just know it was last year and it was a loss.
Had plenty to choose from.
Ah, God, I'm just going to stop there. you know, it's not even that bad. As Iowa fans are doing their IOWA cheer, as, you know, we're all walking out after the game. I just decided to flip them the bird as I was walking by. So yeah, the double bird actually.
You know what though? Somewhere Ryan Tweedy approves. He's not listening. Like it's like that gif, that clip from that movie with Robert Redford where he looks and he smiles approvingly, like nods and smiles.
Jeremiah Johnson.
Thank you. I've never seen the movie.
Walking out of that game, you know, you think you're gonna win. To boot, it was on my 31st birthday. My birthday landed on Black Friday last year. And yeah, I mean they were just cheering, and it wasn't like I'm right next to them inside a fight. I'm down on the ground level outside by the Tom Osborne statue, and in the stands way up high in the north end zone, they're leaning over cheering. So I just flipped them the double bird and kept it pushing. I mean, I would have expected the same thing if I was chanting Go Big Red in Iowa City after we came back and beat them, you know. So all's fair in love, war, and the Big Ten West hatred.
And that is, it's, I feel like we talk about, you know, our rivalry with Oklahoma, which was always out of respect and civility, not so much with Colorado because Colorado's a bunch of douchebags. But you step into the Big Ten and it's just, and you guys made a great point of it last week. It's a meat grinder and everybody hates everybody. And I just want to be a part of that, you know, and when you're 3-9 and when you're, you know, on the bottom half of the conference,
you're on the outside looking in.
Exactly. Exactly. I want teams to not laugh at us or feel sorry for us. I want them to hate us because, you know, we're kicking their teeth in every week.
Well, it's the same principle that if coaches in your conference say that you need to keep your coach, it's not because he's a good coach. It's because they really like to beat him.
Yeah.
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 Well, that about sums it up. But I have a whole list of predictions here that I have written for next week. I don't know if we're doing it game by game or
we are
game at a time this year.
I think the plan is
doing all of them at once.
Well, I know we've always done, you know, like that game week prediction, but mm-hmm. I think we've always also historically said, all right, first up it's Northwestern. You know, who do you think's good? Because inevitably at the beginning of the season, we always say, oh, it's going to be a 10-2 year, you know, something like that. And then, you know, by week three, reality sets in. And we got like, okay, well, I guess we're going to go up against Indiana. And, you know, even though we're coming off a bye, we don't, Scott Frost doesn't perform historically well after a bye week. So I guess it's maybe 21-17. I don't know.
I love when we have like, it's a big game. We're playing a really highly ranked opponent and we're outgunned. And, you know, we know we're probably not going to win the game, but you and I would come up with these ridiculous end of game situations where we pull out a win. Just like, yeah, about that. No, I tried to do this objectively when I was writing them down.
Well, that's super your first mistake.
And here's the thing. I still have us going 10-2. So I'm still drinking Kool-Aid.
I love it. I love it. Perfect. And I think I know what those two may be, but we'll get to that next week. Yep. Haas, before we go, we would be doing a disservice and a dishonor and quite honestly disrespect to the fall sports program on campus that is actually good. And that's the Husker volleyball team. I want to make sure I get the letters right because it's not just NCAA. It's the AVCA Coaches Poll came out earlier this week. And Nebraska is ranked number one in that preseason coaches poll. Texas.
We're good at something.
We are. Unfortunately, two of our best are wearing burnt orange now. And and Texas is preseason number two. Also, we're receiving some first place votes. Wisconsin is number three, also receiving some first place votes. Then it's Louisville, Minnesota, Pittsburgh, Ohio State, Washington, Georgia Tech, BYU. Of the 25 teams on the list, now you'll have to forgive me, I didn't count this up before, but it's Seven teams out of 25, I think, if unless I missed one, which is possible. I apologize. I didn't go to school for maths. I went to school for radios. But 7 out of 25, that's half of the Big Ten. And if you included, you know, the future Big Ten programs, UCLA is in the top 15. USC is in the top 25. Boy, the conference can just get stronger and stronger for volleyball. And it's going to be interesting in this season, certainly in the future of what Nebraska volleyball and Big Ten volleyball and college volleyball is going to look like as that landscape changes. Down the road, we'll have to have Beth on. She's our ace, pun intended, maybe, volleyball reporter for coronation.com. And she can fill us in when we get into the season about all the news and notes and all the happenings that are going on with John Cook's program. But Hoss, as we have kind of established, this has been fun. Always is. It's great catching up with you, buddy.
Yeah. Hey, are we going to do Wednesday night recordings all through the season? Your Thursday nights? Like, what are we thinking here?
Yeah, so when you used to be on the show, I had like a regular day job. And I would be home. I would be home by 5 or 5:30. Mm-hmm. And now my weeks vary. However, if you want, I can make sure if Wednesdays are the nights for you, by the way, folks, we hope you're enjoying this production meeting here on the show. If
behind the scenes, guys,
behind, we're pulling the curtain back a little bit. But if you would prefer, I can make sure that Wednesday evenings,
I mean, like, I always preferred Thursday nights because, you know, it's almost the weekend, you know, drinking some brewskis, some Coors Banquet beers on a Thursday night while doing this podcast. But if it works better to do it Wednesday because it's a little easier for you to get the write-up and everything ready to roll for Friday, let's go with Wednesday. I'm a man of the people.
I appreciate you. From that standpoint, so, again, we are recording this Wednesday, the 17th. It's almost 10 o'clock. So if we were doing this Thursday, I would still have to just, you know, as soon as we're done recording, I'd have to be sitting down, start getting the audio, start getting the video all processed, recorded. Hopefully John would be lucid and awake and able to do the write-up while I'm doing all the fun stuff. This is the truth. The part that takes the absolute longest is uploading the video to YouTube. There will be times where I will start the upload and go to bed and, you know, cross all the T's and dot the I's at 6 a.m. when I come downstairs. That's why I like Wednesday nights. Give me a little breathing room. Instead of recording at 9 o'clock on Thursday, I can be sitting down and doing the production stuff. I'm also flexible. Nothing's etched in stone. I'm sure throughout the course of the season, we'll be getting together on some Thursday nights. I'm here for you, buddy.
Sounds good. But you know what? I look so forward to finally having, you know, I wouldn't want this to be a weekly thing. And just hear me out, because this sounds like I don't want to be on the podcast. It's not what I'm saying. I wouldn't want it to be a weekly thing. But if we get a really, really big win, I'm talking, and you know what kind of teams I'm talking about on the schedule. A really big one. We need to have like an immediate post-game reaction show, like that kind of thing.
We do that now.
I know, but like I've never been a part of it. So like based on schedule, you know, like what I'm doing for the game, where I'm at, you know, like if I'm just watching it at home, for instance, and we pull off something big, oh yeah, I'm hopping on. Maybe I'll have a better laptop, not look like I'm sitting in Guantanamo Bay, you know, on this thing. But yeah, celebratory. Hey. We haven't had much to celebrate. It'd be like Kevin Malone in The Office. It's just nice to win one.
It's just so John has been doing the post game reaction videos. Of course, made him kind of a little famous last year. Famous. as he went viral, that's still circulating around almost a year later, which is tremendous. But he drafted me, recruited me to do some of those as well. And he said, I'm not going to be around. I said, I've got thoughts. He said, you go out and sit outside by a tree and do that. But it's always better to just have the show, you know, have the reaction show. So I've still got all the pieces, all of the music and things like that. So we'll be doing that for sure this year. I'm looking forward. I'm looking. It's just nice to be actually legit talking Nebraska football with the season 8 days away. Bring it on.
It makes me think of how we got through some of those off seasons back in the day, you know, just what do you know? How's it going? You know, basically.
And I was thinking about this too. And real quick before we head out here, folks, is 2017. We took time off in the off season, Brian and I, and looking back, you know, that was his last off season. And I'm really kicking myself that we didn't spend more time, devote more time to the podcast in the off season. Just, you know, just to have fun, just to BS, just to, you know, do these what if scenarios. I just Facebook memories or whatever said, yeah, we're back at it. You know, we decided to get another show out there a couple weeks before the season type of thing. Went after he, you know, passed, of course, and you came on, like, we took a week off a couple weeks ago because you weren't available. Todd wasn't available. And John and I were like, man, we couldn't make the schedules work. It was fine. But other than that, like, I'm pretty sure we've rolled every week now for about 5 years. So
long time.
It's been well worth it. We've certainly we've had a few ups, but a lot more downs.
Only one way to go.
That's right. That's right. When you're rock bottom, you can only see one direction. So we're not rock. What's that?
Stop digging.
That's right. Stop digging. Yeah, Scott, put the shovel down. Yep. All right. That'll do it for this episode of the Five Heart Podcast, folks. We do appreciate you hanging out with us again. Whether you found us on YouTube or subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcast or Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, none other one probably. Make sure you hit that subscribe button. Send some feedback. Throw a comment down on YouTube. I do look at them. I don't take them personally. So, you know, John will be back next week. He won't be at the helm. Sorry, YouTube commenter. But for the man of the hour, Hoss Reuter, I'm Greg Mahochko. This is the Five Heart Podcast, where we remind each and every week that Five Heart is all the heart you need. Hoss?
Go Big Red and win the damn offseason.
Yeah, metal.